I call the Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, February 1st, 2023, and the time is 3:30 p.m. We're here in the Butrovich Room in Juneau, Alaska. And committee members present, we have Senator Clayman, Senator Dunbar, Senator Kaufman, Vice Chair Bishop, Co-Chair Bishop, and I'm Senator Kathy Giesel. I expect Senator Kawasaki and Senator Willikowski will be along soon. Supporting this meeting today, Recording Secretary Carrie Cooper-Ryder, and helping us out on the audio is Amanda Kraft. Thank you so much to both of you who make this meeting possible. And welcome to Senator Willikowski and Senator Kawasaki. Please silence your cell phones. So before we begin, I did reach out to the Department of Revenue with questions that committee members had at the last meeting on Monday, and they said they'd need a little more time to prepare, so we will have them at some point in the future. Today we have one item on the agenda, and we will be continuing the exploration, pun intended, of pending natural gas shortage in Cook Inlet. So our presenters today are the Rail Belt Utilities. So we have General Manager of Homer Electric, Brad Janorski, close, not perfect, CEO of Chugach Electric, Arthur Miller, CEO of Matanuska Electric Association, Tony Izzo, and the President and CEO of Golden Valley Electric, John Burns. So, gentlemen, keep in mind that the public is listening. We have a very large audience in the room as well. But always be aware that the public's interested in this, too, and we have had a lot of listeners online. So when you speak, please identify yourself so that the folks listening can hear, and also Carrie, who's recording the message, or what you're saying, can also record it accurately. Committee members, the panel has requested that you hold questions until after their presentation. So if you notice committee members vibrating, it's because they're so eager to ask you questions. I know there'll be a lot. So, gentlemen, welcome. I'll let you begin with whoever is opening up.
Sure. Good afternoon, Senator. My name is Brad Janorski, General Manager at Homer Electric Association. We do appreciate the opportunity to be here today. Normally, testifying is always difficult for me because I have to sit in a chair, and if you see me speak outside this, I'm always walking around standing up, and the good news is whether I'm standing or sitting, my eyesight's about the same level for the audience, but in this case, I will stay seated for the benefit of the folks that need the microphone. So with that, appreciate it. We have most of the Rail Belt utility managers here today with the exception of Seward, and we'll just let them introduce themselves quickly.
Madam Chair, said John Burns. John Burns with Golden Valley Electric Association in Fairbanks.
Good afternoon. Tony Izzo from Matanuska Electric Association.
Good afternoon. Arthur Miller with Chugach Electric Association.
And thank you, Senator Giesel, for allowing us. Our goal is to just quickly go through these 13 slides because I know there's lots of Q&A and discussion. So we're just going to go very quickly. Most of you know this information, but for the audience and for anybody else listening, it's good backup material. So, Rail Utilities, by the numbers, you guys can read the slide. I won't go through them in too much detail. You already know we serve about 75% of the Alaska's population center, from Homer to the Kenai Peninsula to the interior, Fairbanks. The system stretches about 700 miles from Homer all the way to Delta Junction and in Fairbanks. And you'll see on the following slide, very quickly at a high level, of the transmission system that I'll talk about shortly. Average cost of power, even though we know your constituents and our members think power costs are high, the Rail Belt, as we'll call it today, that serves 75% of the population, the numbers are actually pretty reasonable. If you exclude the Southeast and the hydro, which of course is relatively cheap, we do depend very highly on natural gas, and as a result, we've got very competitive rates. I know a lot of folks like to compare us to the outside, but quite frankly, for Alaska, we are pretty competitive, even with either coast. You look at our rates, look at the Energy Information Administration data, and you'll see that we're in the ballpark of everybody else, which is ironic considering, as you already know, our high dependence on natural gas. We pay on the average of 2 to 3 times what they pay at Henry Hub in the lower 48. So 41% of the Cook Inlet gas is used to produce electricity. The balance of most of that is used at the refinery located up in Nikiski for their products and for in-feed stock, and also by NSTAR for heating and cooking. I referenced in the previous slide just quickly, here's a good overview of the transmission system today. I like to look at the transmission system as a public highway for electrons. So it's kind of a different way of looking at it, but that's exactly what it is. And you'll notice we call it three LBAs, or load balancing areas. One is the Kenai Peninsula. One is the central area, which is Anchorage, Matsu Valley. And the other area is the Fairbanks or the interior. Those three areas, and many of you have driven that road system before, can tell, and have been along there. The transmission, a single radial line that runs between the Kenai Peninsula and Anchorage and up to the interior through avalanche chutes, through very heavily forested areas, a lot of it on public lands. The following slide is just a list of topics my peers are going to cover. It's kind of our agenda slide, and we'll go through it relatively quickly. And again, we appreciate you holding off on questions until we zip through this really quick. Arthur, please.
Well, certainly a critical issue facing the Rail Belt utilities is the continued decline of Cook Inlet gas reserves. And there's no question utilities have benefited significantly over the last 60 years of really a reliable, very affordable supply of natural gas. But the situation is changing. And we certainly heard in May of last year from one of the dominant producers in the Cook Inlet region that they were no longer going to extend existing contracts with the utilities under existing contract structures. In addition to that, just last week, the Department of Natural Resources issued their 2022 reserve report corroborating some of the findings and expectations certainly that we had as utilities on what we're seeing. The impact to us, at least on a contractual basis, is different depending on our contractual, individual contractual relationships with that producer. This chart shows Cook Inlet production levels from year 2000 through 2021 on an actual basis, and then projected from 2022 through 2040. And what I want to mention here is that this trajectory, downward trend, is happening even though significant events have happened, if you will, both on the supply and the demand side. In 2007, Agrium plant was closed that added 50 BCF of gas through a reduction in demand. There was production tax incentives in 2013, 2014, culminating with Hilcorp Alaska's acquisition of Marathon Oil. In 2018, the Kenai export facility closed. And we also recognize when Hilcorp entered the market in 2013-2014 time period, a significant uptake in gas production was there. And we were really in the same situation back then as we are, very similar to where we are today. There's no question additional discoveries in the Cook Inlet will help, but we are on a downward trend that additional discoveries would really kind of, and so to speak, kick the can down the road. But at the end of the day, there is a finite supply of natural gas in Cook Inlet. And what we have to do is look for alternative means by which we can fill this gap. If you go to the next slide. And looking at this on a more specific basis by year, on a projected basis from 2022 to 2041, supply equals demand for the most part all the way through 2026, but in 2027, supply is less than demand, and that trajectory continues to decline over the estimation period. Utility decision making is really driven by reliability to ensure that we are able to serve our customers in a reliable way. But at the same token, rate levels are critical. And what we want to do is put in the optimal number or amount of resources that we can, generation assets, to meet our customer load at the lowest cost that we can while still meeting our reliability criteria and our goals. So the fundamental question as we move forward is, how do we fill the gap between the between supply and demand? And there are several options that we are reviewing in recognition of our obligation for reliable service and low rates. In addition, we're looking at this from the perspective of, we don't want to be here 5 years from now. We don't want to be here 10 years from now. We've been here before 8 years ago. We've been here before prior to that. We want a long-term, permanent solution that benefits Alaskans. Ideally, we want that to be in-state gas. Having said that, we are looking at alternative green, or I should say clean energy technologies. All four of us, four utilities, the biggest in the state, absolutely support clean energy technologies, renewable generation, and we are working collaboratively and looking at options to add renewables onto the system. It's not a panacea. If we look at Fire Island Wind, a 17-megawatt facility, that provides about 0.4 or saves about 0.4 BCF a year. That's in relation to the entire Rail Belt electric utility gas usage of about 24 Bs a year. For Chugach, we're at 14 Bs a year, so it's a very relatively small amount. Having said that, that does not mean we don't support going in after clean energy technologies, and we are. We just recognize that that right now is not the ultimate solution that we need to have as we go and do that. We also need to look at, on those technologies, that is how to integrate those into the system on an effective basis. Certainly battery technology helps in that area. We're also are monitoring, you know, the events of the AK LNG project. There's no question, if that project were to go forward and they were able to deliver gas between $4 and $5 an MCF to South Central Alaska, that's less than half of what we are paying right now as a market clearing price within Cook Inlet. That would be a significant advantage, where the market price right now is roughly $7.50 to $8, somewhere in that area. And the AK LNG project indicated that that price would could be in the $4 to $5 range, delivered price of natural gas. In addition to that, if that project is not able to go forward, although we have heard from Mr. Richards at AK LNG that they can, on a first phase basis, have gas delivered to South Central by 2027-2028 time period, as far as a first stage aspect to it. I also want to say how important are gas prices to our electric bills. They're significant. Gas makes up in the Rail Belt between 20 and 30% of our cost structure. For Chugach, a $1 increase in gas results in a 4% increase to electric rates. So it is very significant. That works in reverse as well. We are also collaborating and we're evaluating and studying LNG import opportunities. That's not the direction we want to take. We think that, unfortunately, would be a very unfortunate situation. A state as rich as Alaska is with natural gas to have to import LNG. However, we recognize we need gas. We want to have a competitive price for that gas. And if that's what it will take to get gas, then we will pursue that. Those efforts are ongoing. We do expect the results of those efforts to be released later this year. I also want to mention When we're talking about options that we're evaluating, right now, it's very wide. We're looking at LNG. Is there other opportunities for further development in any other areas? We're keeping all of our options wide open. But as time goes on, as every month that passes, our options start getting narrower. And we're in a position now where we really need to make a decision on which way we go in the next 12 to 15 months. And that's could be pushing it even at that threshold. So we are working on that. Our ask on this is there's no ask at this point. What we want to do is make sure that you're aware of the situation. And then when we complete our study work, then we can come back and give you what our recommendations are going forward. And then if there's an ask as a result of those efforts, then we will come back to you at that time with that. But we're not at that point yet. We have not defined definitively which direction we're going to go. We're also waiting to see what's going to happen with in-state opportunities of gas. There's also no question that storage capabilities are required. And when we talk about storage capabilities, we're talking about both gas storage and whether the gas comes from the North Slope on a gas line or whether it's shipped in through an LNG project. We still need significant gas storage to make sure we meet demands. In addition to that, we recognize the importance of battery energy technology. In fact, Homer, Golden Valley, and Chugach and MEA, all of us are in the process. Well, Homer has already put in their battery. Chugach is just, and MEA has just purchased a battery collaboratively, and Golden Valley is working on their battery, evaluating options on that. We recognize the importance of battery. Those batteries not only save fuel cost because of the ability to regulate the system better, they also help us integrate renewable generation on a more economic basis. So it's something that we all certainly support. So with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Izzo.
Great. And just for the folks listening at home, that was Mr. Miller from Chugach Electric. Mr. Izzo.
Yes, for the record, my name is Tony Izzo. Co-Chair Giesel, committee members, thank you for the opportunity. I'm going to just really move through two slides pretty quickly because I think Q&A is likely where the value is at. And I could sense that vibrating that Senator Giesel mentioned at the beginning. I would mention, to follow up with Mr. Miller, for Matanuska Electric, we're the second largest population center and we're probably the only utility that's seeing growth. Adding about 1,200 new meters each year. We've just hit the 70,000 mark, and we continue to see influx from other parts of the state. I don't say that to mean that it's a good story for the state. It's just the reality of what we're seeing. If MEA's gas contract is one of the better contracts in that the price is slightly lower, about $7.50, $8 delivered on the pipeline system to the power plant. If that price were $5 delivered, it would put $10 million a year back into the economy, just in the valley, $10 million a year. The approach going forward is something that we've all been working on diligently. I'm excited about the collaboration that's been in place and only growing in for years now. And I've got a slide here of a couple of just the focus of a few things that we're working on. First, diversification. In reality, to be a prudent utility, you've got to have a diversified fuel supply. I think that test was clearly met years ago when you had decades worth of gas or overhang was discovered when exploring for oil in the 50s and 60s. Wellhead pressures were hundreds of PSI higher than they are today, at least on the NSTAR pipeline. So diversification is a key that we all agree on. A sensible approach with no adverse effect on rates or reliability. If we could, start immediately replacing generation with something new. Many of the technologies are not here yet, just like a North Slope gas pipeline is not here yet. So if we were to replace it with things that are, say, non-firm, wind or solar, you still need the thermal generation to back that up. For MEA, for example, if we were to become 50%, if we were to become 40% renewable, and currently we're about 16%, but if we were to get to 40%, which I believe will be a goal that we'll be talking about soon, we still need two-thirds of the gas supply that we have today. So instead of 6 billion cubic feet, we need 4 billion cubic feet. So that's what I'm talking about in regards to sensible approach. We don't want to do what's called rate shock, and we certainly don't. None of us signed up for rolling blackouts. None of us sitting at this table want to see anything like that happen. We think that the policy or the focus that we're working on will encourage collaboration with stakeholders. Stakeholders is just a word that means a variety of stakeholders, including independent power producers and others. For example, I don't have to be in the generation business. If someone were to come to my door, and if they had to date with lower price power, I would buy it. That's the bottom line. Of course, I have to maintain reliability. Provides energy security. I hesitate to say this on the record, but it's just the truth. We have one of the most fragile systems in the United States. I don't refer to the Alaska Rail Belt system as first world, because it's not. If we were in the lower 48, we would have to have two transmission lines, where today we just have the one. And in none of those markets do they operate in a seismic, subarctic, and volcanic climate like we do. And in those other states, they are connected to what's referred to often as an infinite grid. So a solution going forward has got to address the need for energy security. And then we're all in complete agreement about looking for opportunity to maximize carbon reduction. It's clear that there's a transition in the industry. Technology is advancing quickly. And we want to plan for that in the most prudent way possible. I have a cost comparison slide. I won't spend a lot of time on this. It shows you at the top the 2020 Hawaii wind power purchase agreement is the line across the top. That's over $160 per megawatt hour. The next line from the top is Eva Creek Wind. And then there's a lighter blue line below that. That's northeastern U.S. Solar. Fire Island Wind is in red. You can see the Rail Belt utility average is the dotted line, and this southern U.S. region is solar. Mr. Janorski indicated that prices, we often hear that our prices are twice what they are in the lower 48, and so I brought just an update from a Department of Labor report or Bureau of Labor. So it's a federal report on the December 2022 prices around the country, and I thought I would just rattle some off, and starting with the cities you can just fly directly to. Seattle being the exception is at 12 cents, and so the average is about 19, 20 cents in the rail belt. So they're 12 cents. That's primarily because of Bonneville Power. It's the majority is hydropower. If you fly to Hawaii, that's 45 cents. If you go to LA, you can get a direct flight to LA. That's 26 cents. Minneapolis on Delta is 16 cents, Chicago 15 cents, New York City 23 cents, and Boston 35 cents. So the national average as of December 2022 was 16.2 cents per kilowatt hour, comparing to our roughly 20 cents. That is not a justification. These are just data points. We all want to see lower prices, which will facilitate economic development, the health of the entire state, our economy, as well as our members and ratepayers. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Burns to talk about the Rail Belt vision.
Thank you, Tony. Madam Chair, gentlemen, appreciate the opportunity to be here. My name is John Burns. I have the privilege of serving as President and CEO of Golden Valley Electric Association. You've heard already the importance and criticality of having a stable supply of natural gas. You've also heard the desire to diversify and the need to diversify generation. And the simple reality is that you also have to transmit it over a reliable, robust transmission system. And the rail belt's vision regarding transmission is very pointed. It is to lower the cost of electricity along the entire rail belt to ensure that the lowest cost electron can be dispatched from wherever it is generated, from whatever source, be that renewable, hydro, nuclear, or carbon-based, to wherever it is needed, reliably, efficiently, and at the lowest cost possible. And we would advocate that by doing so, to serve as a catalyst for economic growth. To achieve that vision requires a reliable, resilient, redundant transmission system, a system that is unconstrained, that is not vulnerable to a single point of failure, and that has the capacity to accommodate energy generation from all potential sources, regardless of where it is constructed along the rail belt. Implementing this vision requires four stages. The first is upgrading the existing transmission system, the solid line that you see there. Second is adding additional southern and northern transmission lines. And third, building the road belt transmission line, the line that you see that goes from Anchorage, Palmer, Glen Allen up to Delta. And fourth, adding energy storage strategically along the rail belt at Homer, Anchorage, and in Fairbanks. What this vision will achieve is nothing short of transformational for the rail belt and for the state. And these are some of the objectives that will be achieved. Increased generation availability and unconstrained dispatch to be able to get it from wherever, whenever, at the lowest price. Increased clean energy generation. We talk about the need to diversify. You know, Fairbanks is looking at the opportunity to add additional renewable. You know, in order, the line is constrained at 70 megawatts. So you've got a natural constraint on the existing intertie. Increased transfer capabilities, I've indicated. Economies of scale. The difference between a 40 megawatt wind project at 10 and 11 cents kilowatt and 100 megawatt at 6 and 6.5 cents is huge. Supports our military's mission in Alaska. We are fortunate to have 5 military bases on the rail belt. They need reliable energy. And currently, you know, we have issues with the rail belt. They island themselves instantaneously. And finally, rate stability along the rail belt. In doing so, will also provide benefits in PCE communities. Because as you all know, that the cost on the rail belt allow that the delta is beneficial on the PCE. This next slide really talks about legislative priorities. As committed as the four of us and five of us, Rob Montgomery with Seward was not able to be here, as committed as the rail belt utilities are to achieving this vision, the simple reality is that it cannot be achieved without sustained leadership and a commitment at all levels. We have all heard that Alaska is the land of opportunity. But I would submit to you that opportunity alone will not reverse the decade-long stagnant economy, nor will it reverse the fact that since 2015, percentage-wise, more residents have left Alaska than any other state in the nation. What is required is action and a sustained commitment to transform a vision into reality. As you work this session with the governor to govern and guide Alaska's future, we would respectfully propose 4 legislative priorities to drive down energy costs and to promote economic growth. Reasonably priced, long-term, preferably in-state supply of natural gas that we've talked about. Transmission infrastructure and energy storage buildouts. Leveraging state and federal money to maximize the opportunity to achieve the transmission upgrades that we've talked about. An economic, affordable transition to lower carbon. These are heavy lifts. We stand absolutely committed to assisting in any way that we can to achieve those objectives. And I'm happy to say that that is the last slide from this group here. We open it up and we invite any questions because we are all in this together.
All right, committee members, questions? Senator Bishop.
Oh, Senator Kaufman was first. I'll yield to Senator Kaufman.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'll just say to the panel and speak up as you think best. The master schedule timeline, I heard allusion to a plan. So this is a transition plan, a management plan. Is there yet a schedule of the transition? And in a project, I look for a resource-loaded integrated schedule that shows not only all of the tasks, but all of the resources that will be needed for the tasks and how they'll be delivered. Is there such a document that currently exists for this transition?
You know, there's no specific document. We have been evaluating it. We've got members that are looking at different aspects with AEA. We've also developed what are the required projects moving forward. In fact, we are committed, the railroad here has committed $166 million already to the build-out of some of the southern transmission, upgrading some of the southern transmission. And so we are, you know, committed and focused on it, and it will be phases. This will be a 10 to 12 year build out. And, you know, the irony is I have the opportunity to read there's in 2010, AEA put out the plan. It was called Alaska's Energy Pathway in 2010. And it was talking about much of the exact same thing that we were talking about here today. And it talked about the fact that if we commit to it and start, we'll have it paid for in 20 years. Well, we're 13 years into it. And so that's where we're at is, you know, we really do need to take the bull by the horn, so to speak. The rail belt utilities can only do so much. We can't, you know, the point is to drive down the cost. And it's going to take federal and state efforts. As I said, we've committed $166 million moving forward. And that is in the work. We talk about action. That's moving forward right now.
And I'll let Senator Kaufman.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair. And so earlier, against that plan, so you have the transmission, you have the timeline, deployment, all of the various energy sources that need to be online. Earlier, the slide that shows the relative costs. Do we have a relative cost for the individual source of supply for those powers? So across the whole spectrum of energy being pumped into the grid or the future grid, I know it's not here, but could we get the information as what the current cost per kilowatt is for the various sources?
Senator Kaufman, through the chair.
Identify yourself, please, Mr. Izzo.
This is Tony Izzo, for the record. To first add on to Mr. Burns, I would say that there are some hurdles or stage gates that are in place. Our collective work here, along with NSTAR and the Interior Gas Utility, is analyzing gas supply options. I look at this as maybe triaging a patient. I have to have gas supply because the infrastructure is in place, the assets are in place to produce reliable power today. And so we're working on one front on that, and we're expecting to know something by June. Now, all of us would like that to be tomorrow. And as Mr. Miller stated earlier, we're in the process now of narrowing down, again, along with NSTAR and the Interior Gas Utility, narrowing down options. And with that will come costs associated with them and variables in terms of whether they're short-term, long-term, capital costs, et cetera. Another stage gate in all of this is transmission, because to change the paradigm, we have, I mentioned earlier, a fragile system that is essentially what the ratepayer can afford. We don't have the redundancy. We'd like to have a second line to Bradley Lake. Well, if that cost $100 million and we were able to more efficiently use that, the ratepayer would not see. They wouldn't. I couldn't go to them and say, instead of that two-week outage you get every year, that goes away. So we have expectations that are kind of built into the culture, and we just have the system that we can afford. But the transmission applications that we're coordinating, especially with the Alaska Energy Authority, those have been filed, and we are waiting. We have 2 to 3 months to determine from Department of Energy if we're going to be invited to apply. And that's where we could spend over some 15-year period, $2.9 billion, to essentially have a transmission system that would be equivalent to a first-world country. But more importantly than that, when Mr. Burns mentioned today, if GBEA, as John indicated, were to go out and look for a wind project, it might be 40 megawatts, and that's going to be 11 cents a kilowatt hour. I could not justify and take 11 cents to the regulatory commission. In current statute, it wouldn't be approved unless I could demonstrate that I was out of gas tomorrow, because it's not in the consumer interest. It's too expensive. But as he mentioned, if it was 100 megawatts, and one of the things that we're all collectively looking at as a group, now you're talking about maybe 6 cent power, but you have to have the infrastructure to get it to us. And with constrained interties today, we're just limited. The other consideration in that regard is we are analyzing things like wind. There are met towers up around the system that are looking at the quality of wind. Unfortunately, we don't find those in the population centers, so there's going to be some transmission and infrastructure needed just to get to those places. I apologize, Senator, because I want to make sure that I'm clear on your second question. I jumped in to answer it, and I just, through the chair, if you wouldn't mind repeating part of that.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Izzo. The piece that I'm worried about is, as I hear of our great energy transition, there's always talk of renewables. Well, that scares me because there's alternatives. So there's nuclear. And so I hear of energy resilience and energy security as I hear us walking away from sources that are fine. So that's why I was asking about, and I'm not sure really if you hit this, was about how our current and future palette of energy supply, of methods of delivering power, how this plays into this plan and what our transition plan is from current state, optimizing it as we transition to the next state as far as our energy blend, what we're putting in the grid. And I recognize that an improved grid will help transmit that, will actually act as reserve capacity for alternatives that are not as reliable, we'll say, in terms of steady state power delivery. They're not base load to that extent unless you can accurately or adequately transmit them. So that's what I'm looking for, is the transition plan that mitigates the risk of transitioning from where we are now to the future. And I'm hearing that's this plan that's going to come out. Maybe that's the answer.
Yes, Senator Kaufman, through the chair, Tony Izzo for the record. We absolutely are working on the various inputs to a plan. We haven't committed yet to a deadline on that. I will give you an example from Matanuska Electric's perspective. We have 100% of the gas that we need. MEA is 84% natural gas, 16% renewable, which is Bradley Lake, Aklutna Hydro, and a smattering of smaller independent power. We have an ability through our natural gas plant to regulate some of those non-firm renewables. And we are almost at that capacity, the 10-megawatt solar farm that will come on. Think about December when the snow was going sideways, 40-mile-an-hour sustained winds, 75-mile-an-hour gusts, multiple outages. To your point, the current technology of renewables would not have allowed me to keep the power on. So this is the group here that is ultimately held responsible by the Regulatory Commission and our various boards for reliability. And I can assure you that that is a key consideration that none of us want. And it's part of the reason why you hear us and you heard me say, I still need 4 billion cubic feet of gas in 2040, even if I'm 50% reduced on carbon, 42% renewable. So it's a Gordian knot, frankly, that we're looking at right now, to be told that we can't supply more than maybe half of what you're going to need. And I started to talk about MEA. I have all the gas under contract I need through March 31 of 2028. On April 1, the next day, I have zero. Now, I believe that Hilcorp will step up and there'll be some additional contract. But what they have indicated is it might be only half. And so I have 5 years, you know, to figure out permit, finance, you know, collectively together to ensure reliability and also attempt to shift away from this groundhog day of a paradigm where every 10 years we're trying to breathe additional life into something that only seems to cost more.
Thank you.
Senator Bishop, you are next.
Well, I'll just throw this out. This is fun. This is going to be all night. But I just want to throw it out to the table. What would you do if you had $1.3 billion? How would you solve your problem?
Yeah. Sure. Great question, Brad Janorski, General Manager of Home Electric, through the co-chairs. That's a great question. What would we do if we had $1.3 billion? And we haven't discussed this question, but I think my peers are not shy and will speak up if they disagree. Probably the first and foremost would be improving the transmission of the redundancy and focused on batteries. One of the things I've told the legislators I've had a chance to visit with the last couple of days is you can improve the transmission system, you can add batteries, but at the end of the day, if we don't have gas, it doesn't matter. None of that matters. Education is important, PFD is important, but if we don't have gas and the lights go out, nothing else matters. I'm kind of jealous of envious of Mr. Izzo. He has 4 years more than I have under gas contract. 14 months from yesterday is the last I have of gas under contract. We are working with multiple suppliers, and between them and us, we are working diligently to make sure that we continue to have a firm supply of gas after April 1st, 2024. It's not that far away, like I've told people. And I know if you talk to different folks, they'll say importing LNG is a good transition until we get a pipeline or some other secure source. And it's taken me a while to warm up to that, considering we're right along Cook Inlet. Many of the areas we serve, like Kenai and Nikiski, those folks have been born and raised off of natural gas and oil their entire lives, and that's how they survive. Going to our members to say we need to get import for a while is like trying to convince an Alaskan that farmed salmon is good for you. You know what? Put a bullseye on my back, because it's a very similar analogy. And so we are working hard to address that. I think through the chair, Senator Kaufman's question about additional resources today, and I apologize because my back is to the audience, so I can't see everybody behind me, but I do want to recognize from AEA, Curtis Thayer, the executive director, has done a lot of help with the utilities and representing the state's interests in both Bradley Lake and helping us with the $166 million that Mr. Burns had referenced. In my mind, the second best investment the state of Alaska has ever made behind TAPS was Bradley Lake. We get Bradley Lake power up for about 5 cents per kilowatt hour. Our most efficient natural gas-fired unit, including the fuel, is running about 13.5 cents a kilowatt hour. So it's 2.5 times more expensive than it is large-scale hydro. And quite frankly, Bradley Lake isn't that large scale, but it is in Alaska. And to this day, I think any of the four of us would give anything to be 100% renewable, depending only on Bradley Lake or some other large-scale resource. So we have our work cut out for us, and I think, as Mr. Miller stated, no particular request today, and we are certainly looking at different studies to see how we can make sure. One of the key things I've told my board was our first priority is to keep the lights on. Secondly, it's to keep the upward pressure off of rates. Many of my peers, you've heard them say that we'd like to see rates go down. I'm not there, and I'm an optimist. I just want to keep the upward pressure off of rates. In our particular case, we are depending on the year. Last year, we were about close to 90% dependent on natural gas. It represents about one-third of a member's electric bill. One-third each month of a residential bill is a straight pass-through. There's nothing in that to help a member, help pay for poles, wires, employees, insurance. It is a straight pass-through from the suppliers for natural gas to our members. So any increase in the price of gas is a direct pass-through for our members. None of that helps the cooperative pay our bills other than our natural gas.
Gentlemen, take follow-up.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, Arthur Miller. I think you're going to hear very similar responses to your question.
So let me jump in there. The reason I say this is because we've seen this movie before. I think one of you guys alluded to that, didn't use the word movie, but we've been here before. So my point in saying that is we're all wanting to fix the problem, right? So I'm just saying the state has put $1.3 billion in cash credits in Cook Inlet over a 10-year, 11, 12-year period. And here we are looking down the gun barrel again. So $1.3 billion, you know, that, just as a starting point. And I've heard transmission upgrade, so that's accurate, but there you go.
Thank you. So I think the best use of those funds, if we look at the Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project, that project, not only does it displace gas, it's a clean energy technology. And the useful life of that facility is not equivalent to a traditional natural gas generator of 35 years. We're looking at an asset with a life of 100 years. It's a phenomenal benefit. That benefit is generational and goes right to our members and right to the consumers in Alaska for decades in the future. It really hits all prongs of what we're after. We're after clean energy. We're after, as Mr. Izzo said, diversification and generation, and reduce our reliance on gas. And it's a long-lived asset, and through time, that gets cheaper and cheaper with inflationary, given the significant upfront physical or fixed costs associated with the facility. So I think that would be the best use of those types of funds for long-term benefit to Alaskans.
Senator Bishop, through the chair, for the record, this is Tony Izzo. I'll just be direct. I think $1.3 billion, I could spend time talking about what literally happened as a result of tax credits being vetoed, and I'm not saying they're right or wrong. The day they were vetoed, their MEA and Chugach had negotiated a 10-year supply for $5. And the day they were vetoed, we were signing term sheets, and the borrowers started to call the producer and told them, you're not going to get, you can't borrow the 92% that was ING, and the whole deal evaporated. So I'd have to go back and say, what was the value of that $2.50 or so in difference in gas? But let me be more direct about your question. I think there's a couple of things here. We need gas. That's the infrastructure we have, like it or not. So some of $1.3 billion needs to secure. We can't be in a position where the plan is rolling blackouts on a peak day. That's not a smart thing. We need to invest the majority of that in infrastructure so that we can shift the paradigm. And infrastructure is agnostic to fuel. Yes, it has to be reliable, but as technologies evolve, I think about the neighbor that bought a Betamax. And By the time I could afford a VCR, they were $49. Things change. Technology evolves. So security of supply for some interim period, that might look like having to pay a little bit more, unfortunately, for the gas that we can produce in the interim versus making some significant hundreds of millions of dollars investment in something like LNG import, which is going to create another host of issues. Thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, relative to the transmission, it's a systematic build out over time, and you can't flood it and expect it to spend 1.3, overnight. It would be ideally about a $250 million, $300 million tranche over the next 5 years. And then you just build out systematically and think about as that moves forward, job opportunities, job growth within Alaska. The ancillary benefit from that becomes huge in terms of being able to integrate diverse generation into the system. So there's no question that, that this is a heavy lift. We've talked, in terms of the total package on transmission alone is about 2.9. You build out over time. And what you're trying to achieve is an investment that really pays dividends in the long run, where you actually are doing something that grows an economy. The road belt that we talked about does provide the opportunity for economic growth. I mean, in areas of the state that are, unserved by electricity, the opportunity for mining that can be developed in those areas, it's endless. But we have to do it systematically and very progressively as far as the build-out is concerned. So.
Follow up, Senator Bishop.
Let's look to see if there's any other questions. Right. Yep. So I hear a lot about clean energy. You'll use clean energy if it's available. Does that include coal if it had a direct capture sequestration? Do you buy coal power?
I think that falls under the definition of clean energy as carbon sequestration. Through the chair, Arthur Miller.
Anybody else want to comment?
Sure. Through the chair, Brad Janorski. It's a great question, Senator, about using coal. I grew up in the Midwest, and I love coal. Not all of my membership does, but clean coal that would lower the price of energy, I would certainly support. I do, and just a side note, I had one of my bosses, a board member, say, Brad, we need to just go build a coal plant. He recognizes that we're not very diverse, and unless you're a gas expert, like one of my peers, Mr. Izzo, to put it in perspective, when he referenced if he's 50% renewable, he still needs 4 Bs a year. That's Homer Electric's annual consumption. So you can kind of visualize, even if he's 50% renewable, he still needs as much gas as that we use today to serve the entire Kenai Peninsula, 95% of our annual needs. In fact, the last time we went out for bids, we split it into a 5-year agreement. Instead of asking for 4 Bs a year, we asked for 2 Bs a year, and we did 2 contracts, hoping to get more bidders. Most of you know by now how many bidders we had. One bidder. Try negotiating with one bidder. It's a challenge. I'm very appreciative and thankful for them because the producers aren't here to defend themselves and at this table. I put myself in their shoes and I get it. When the export facility shut down, once the 4 of us and NSTAR signed contracts in the refinery, if you're an exploration company, where are you going to sell your gas? If you've got nowhere to send it, there's no market. The utilities just got locked up. I think I'll speak for all my peers. We love long-term contracts, long-term baseload contracts to fill our needs so we can move on and run our businesses. If I'm an exploration company, I just go, wow, where am I going to sell it when the export facility shut down? I think we saw a change in our business when that export facility went away. That's why we ended up with only one. One of the things I had told one of my bosses, who said, Brad, we should build a coal plant. I says, I agree. I love coal. We are 85 to 90% dependent on one resource right now. It's If we had five suppliers, it might be a different story. But from a business risk perspective, having 85% to 90% of your needs in one commodity, let alone one producer, supplier, is really not a good spot to be in a business. I don't think any of us would have, and I've told some of the senators this in the past, I don't think any of us would have a financial advisor tell us to put 85 to 90% of your 401k in a single stock. If you put it in Enron, I won't say the rest of them that I used before because it's public. You could be working till you're 150 and you'll still be broke. So my point being is we are looking to diversify. One of the things I told a board member that said, Brad, my response was, we'll never get a permit to do that. And he said, build it anyway. And my response was, I'm too old to go to jail. So he thought it was kind of humorous, and so did I, a little. But I shared it with my wife, and she didn't think it was so funny. So we would certainly consider it. We are looking at all opportunities to reduce our cost, reduce the upward pressure on our cost of power. For an example, I hear a lot of claims about using independent power producers. And I think, as Mr. Izzo alluded, any of us would, if there's a cheaper source, we'll go after it. Happy to do so. We were actually, because since our Tesla batteries that we installed in January of last year, wonderful success. If for no other reason, and a lot of people like to say, well, they're used to store energy. That's true, but we're using them more to control the ramp rates of non-firm resources when they come along, create that opportunity. And we actually use them for spinning reserve when we're islanded. One of the things that we learned and I took to the board, here's an independent power producer that had a large solar project for us. It was actually taking the upward pressure off of rates. And they gave us options. I said, give us options. Management likes options. Boards like options. You guys like options. So we gave, we got lots of options. Some included batteries to control the ramp rate, which would more easily integrate that new resource into our system without interrupting our reliability or causing outages or problems on our system, which is a big deal when you serve a refinery. They notice instantaneously if you're not spot on, and you get a phone call immediately, as you should. We came back and said, we want the lowest cost possible. We have our own batteries. We'll use that to help integrate it to the grid. If you can make it bigger, great. If you can't, that's fine too. And the independent power producer, the board approved it. The independent power producer went back to the landowner, and the landowner said, never got back to him. And we go, wow. So the difference being is independent power producers and other stakeholders you hear from don't have the obligation that we have to make sure the lights stay on. They'll move on to a different site, hopefully on our system. We are working with them. But it's no skin off their back. Well, it is, but our members don't see that. They just move to a different system. It gets postponed a year or two. We don't have that luxury. So sorry I got on a little tangent there, Senator, but I am kind of passionate about this issue.
I haven't even got started yet, but go ahead.
Further questions, Senator Bishop?
No, I'm going to pass this. I yield to my
Senator Klayman, you were next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This first question, a short question for each of you, which is, as I look at page 6, the Rail Belt gas forecast, as I look at this graph and as I hear the testimony, it appears that in 2027, your shortage of gas means you have a production, capacity shortage that, unless you have different views in your individual utilities, it's across the board for all four of you. But I want to know where you all are on that question. But the second part of the question is, assuming you agree with this graph that in 2027 you're going to be short of gas and you're going to be short on production capacity, and I'll assume, although it isn't the best possible, assume we don't have AKLNG online providing that gas, what is your first option that you're going to use to fill that gas?
Senator Klayman, through the chair, Arthur Miller. The impact to the utilities really is different based on contractual requirements with Hillcorp. Number one, I will say Chugach is in a vastly different situation than the other utilities. Chugach owns two-thirds working interest in the Beluga River Unit gas field. Today, more than 50% of our gas requirements are met through that two-thirds ownership interest. And where we see a shortfall in the first year is in 2028. We don't drop off to zero. Our contract with Hilcorp ends at the end of first quarter of 2028. But in addition to that, we still have fairly significant amounts of gas out of the Beluga River unit, but we're still short in 2028. So the question, your question, Senator, is what are we doing to fill and look at filling that gap? Even before the Hilcorp announcement last year in May, Chugach issued an RFP for renewable energy projects wide open. And we had quite a bit of interest and proposals that were submitted. And as a result of that effort, we're now evaluating two large-scale renewable projects, one solar and one wind project. We should have the results of those studies completed by second quarter. The factors that are involved in evaluating those projects include interconnection requirements, but also, and most importantly, the ability to integrate those projects into our system in an efficient manner. And that's where the battery technology comes in and provides a lot of assistance in that. However, both those projects, while utility scale, would put a small dent, if you will, in our gas requirements. Approximately, I would say 1.5 BCF a year is what we'd could be looking at as a reduction from those two projects. Again, we need to finish up on the studies on that. So your question is, if the Alaska LNG project didn't go forward, what would be our option? And I think the option that's going to probably come out from this effort is importing LNG. That probably, on a preliminary basis, indicates a 3 to 5 year time period once a decision is made for that project to become operational. But we are getting to a decision point. We really cannot wait. This is something we can't wait 2 years for. We really need to make a decision in the next 12 to 15 months on which direction we're going to go. I think there's some positive developments that LNG importing could be a transition to an Alaska LNG project. They're very modular units. That could be put on or taken off and resold if it's not needed. But that, there's several studies that are ongoing right now with that, and we should have the results of those studies will inform us as we go forward.
Just a brief follow-up on this. So the really short answer is that Chugach views that the shortfall comes in 2028, different than the graph that we have on page 6, and your first alternative for gas is going to be imported LNG.
If there's no gas line, and we heard from Mr. Richards from AGDC earlier that on a first stage project they could get gas to South Central by 2027, 2028 time period.
Optimistic too.
Optimistic.
I'm just trying to say if that isn't happening, or if it doesn't come on that line, then you're looking at importing LNG.
Unfortunately, yes.
Okay. And I'm curious if they kind of the same response from the other three to see their perspective.
We'll let them each answer.
Senator Klayman, through the chair, for the record, this is Tony Izzo. So my interpretation, I've looked at these kinds of graphs for 40 years in Alaska since 1999. I've seen us come what we referred to as the cliff many times. I think for just historical background, as a buyer, formerly at NSTAR Natural Gas, I watched the Regulatory Commission deny a contract that would have, it was more than 10 years, 12-month trailing average of Henry Hub, and three commissioners voted no. Decision was, I think it was October 11th of 2006. And on that day, Marathon, Chevron, Unocal all told me, we're done here. We're going to pack up. Give us 3 years. And they kept their word. So we have a situation that I don't think I say that for a couple of reasons, because I interpret this graph two different ways. One way, the optimist in me looks at this graph and says, well, I've been here and I've seen worse. By 2009, when all those producers were gone and before Hilcorp came in, the only gas I could get for MEA was 20% of our supply at $10 from one of the producers that's now gone, one of the majors. It isn't that the gas wasn't there. It's just they were for sale. I can't speak for them. So those days, you were lucky to find gas for a 1 or 2 year contract. That's one. That's the most optimistic I can be. Is that acceptable? No. But as I look at this as someone who worked with gas utilities for a long time, I can tell you one view is that contractually, I have with Hilcorp 100% all requirements contract through March 31 of 2028, and I have every reason to believe that they will honor that agreement and do whatever it takes. There's an old saying, you never hang a utility off of one well. They have a lot of wells. They have the balance sheet to back it up. That's why some of the smaller producers with maybe 1, 2, 3 wells with one line in make a utility kind of nervous. What if something were to happen? But I also look at this, and I have done the analysis internally for my own utility. And we see deliverability problems as soon as 2025. You look at that line across the top, and then you look at the blue and red. They don't exceed that dark, straight line all the way. And so, from that different business I was in, I look at this and I say I have serious risk if I see a serious or a cold snap. If we have Alaska winters like I experienced in 99, and if only a few times since, where you have a sustained 20 below. That leads me to the next option. What would MEA do? Because the answer isn't just simply one thing or the other. Well, the first thing I would do is I've got diesel backup. I think the only utility with that kind of capability from South Central or on the Kenai. And I keep 4 or 5 days. So if I needed to burn some diesel for a couple hours or just to make up those peaks, I could. Again, contractually, I think Hilcorp will. But those days are going to be the canaries in the coal mine if they occur in 25, 6, 7, or 8. Beyond that, it's a multi-pronged approach. We're also interested in partnering on any kind of large-scale renewable. But the bottom line is I've got to have gas, and I find it, in just some commentary here, I find it so frustrating, although LNG import is going to be the answer, I'm sure there's going to be some investment needed. Yes, you can resell. Yes, it's off-the-shelf technology. I was an operator in 83 or 4 of an LNG regas facility, a peaker plant in New Jersey, and when it got real cold, we, cooled down the plant and took LNG and vaporized it and pumped it out in the system. And we did it because it was, in many cases, cheaper for the ratepayer. I'm just concerned. I also just want to share with you, I will call it pragmatism. I have all the faith in the world in AGDC and Mr. Richards. But as a utility CEO, that's a big zero on my radar. I cannot assume that's going to happen. And now what I would love to see is in that 12 to 15-month period that Mr. Miller mentioned, if I see some material effort forward that I can, with a straight face, be convinced that that will be there. Again, we should still be working on transmission infrastructure so that we can shift the paradigm, clean up emissions, et cetera. But I can't plan for that. And my fear is that we're going to have to make a significant investment. And it's just my gut tells me that 2 years after that, we're going to be breaking ground on a, you know, North Slope pipeline.
Mr. Jaworski?
Just as a brief call. So the short the short answer is maybe as early as 2025, you've got a shortfall and
I can fill those.
You don't see a path that doesn't involve importing LNG in the short term.
Senator Klayman, through the chair, again, Tony Izzo for the record, yes, once I hit 2028, I do not. The logistics, the permitting, it takes me 3 years to order transformers, 2 years to order poles. Line trucks take 2 years. Yes, sir.
Brad, did you want to answer?
Yes, to the co-chair. Senator Klayman, a short answer, although this graph assumes the demand stays constant, which I think it will drop over time, there still obviously is going to be a shortfall. And I think whether I want to say it out loud or not, at some point, imports will be part of the transition plan from everything I've heard so far.
And is your timeline when you think that's likely to more 28, 27, 25? Where do you put that on the line?
For the record, Brad Janorski, even though our supply runs out April 1st of next year, unlike MEA, we're fortunate we live on the Kenai Peninsula, which, quite frankly, Nikiski is the Henry Hub of Alaska for deliverability. So it's just a matter of getting the supply, and I'm fairly optimistic that the suppliers will not allow the Kenai Peninsula to go into black. That would be a major issue for the entire state. So I think at some point, even with reduced demand and reduced, in our case, reduced concern about deliverability, I do think there will be a shortfall in the reasonable future, and I think between that and when a long-term solution is going to occur is going to include importing LNG. And if investing in an import facility is a way to guarantee within 2 years that we'll have the pipeline started, I'll say invest today. So,
Mr. Burns?
Senator Klayman, through the chair, John Burns, Golden Valley. We in Golden Valley service territory very much, very different than South Central. We have very little gas. So just recently, we were able to get a one-year contract with NSTAR, and it's burned by CEA. But our problem is that we pay the highest on the rail belt. Our members pay the highest. And so, you know, part of the transition to lower cost is importing, you know, energy up the intertie from South Central, because it is some of the cheapest source of energy that we have. We're fortunate that we have a very diverse energy source, but it's also very, very expensive where we are. 38% is diesel. We've got 44% of it is coal. Then the other is we've got some hydro, but the gas that's coming up. We are in the position of adding additional environmental upgrades on our Healy Unit 1 plant, which is our most reliable plant. It's the cheapest energy that we have other than Bradley. And we are also in the position of shutting down Healy Unit 2, which is the one that we bought from ADA many years ago, not because it's not so much driven by environmental issues, but because it is the most unreliable. And so when it's not running, we have to burn diesel. And so our members are paying between $200 to $300 a megawatt hour, significantly more than what it currently costs. So there's a saying that a rising tide raises all boats. And so, you know, I have been steadfast in you know, looking at my three peers here and saying we are in this together. And so if it's imported natural gas, so be it. We are also moving forward with adding additional renewable. We hope to have an RFP out not in the not too distant future. It's also tied to long duration energy storage. You can't have a renewable that you can't really rely on or regulate. So it's complicated, but it truly is. We are all in this situation together. We'll diversify to the extent that we can.
Thank you.
I just have one last question, which
only one of them needs to answer. That took longer than I had hoped.
People waiting to ask.
Yeah, we passed Senate Bill 123 a couple of years ago, creating an electric reliability organization, which seems to be very related to the transmission issue that you all have talked about. If one of you could give us a good picture on when we think that's actually going to be up and running, because it seems like it should have been there by now.
Senator Klayman, through the chair, Tony Izzo for the record. The Regulatory Commission has certificated the RRC, Rail Belt Reliability Council, as the electric reliability organization. That decision was made in recent months. There's an ongoing filing that's dealing with tariff and budget that is likely, I think for the sake of discussion, to be adjudicated or resolved likely later this year. I think that's really a question for the Regulatory Commission or someone from representing the RRC. Then from there, I would point out that an integrated resource plan would be developed, which I think is a great thing. And you know, it's the RRC or the ERO or SB 123 was meant to find the best fit for the rail belt regarding the need for institutional reform. And it created a body by which is intended to adopt and enforce reliability standards that are consistent across the so-called grid that we have, and to conduct a joint integrated resource plan so that we're looking at the entire system. Long time coming, and I'm very pleased. But it could take a few years. Some will say 5 to 7. I'm more optimistic of 2 to 3. And that will essentially define what the future might look like and would have to take into consideration cost, reliability, you know, all the things that we talk about that go into the kind of decision making. I think you've already identified the issue is that it's, you know, it isn't at that point today. That would be very helpful. I would also take the opportunity to mention that it's why, although maybe I should just speak for MEA, I think it's the group of us in that, you know, clean energy is something we want to see based on technology improvement, lower costs, carbon reduction are all great things, and that is a future that we will that we will get to. A mandated or statutory renewable portfolio standard, on the other hand, really shifts the economics, where now I've got to determine, am I recovering through fines? Am I going down to the commission every year and asking for forgiveness because I didn't make some goal because I can't get that infrastructure in a year, or I couldn't permit that wind farm across the hay flats or wherever it might be? It really does shift the balance, and I think we're already collectively deciding that that's where we're going to go. But unfortunately, the Gordian knot is we've got to have the gas to get us and the infrastructure to allow and facilitate, and then we can do all of those kinds of things down the road.
Thank you. Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, I'll try and make it brief. I know we're running short on time here, but just one point to make for Mr. Jaworski. I think the last big plant, as far as coal goes, was probably like 10 years ago or something like that. So I don't know that that's an option, but I do appreciate the work that all of the utilities have been doing on clean energy goals and your pledge to, as best you can, reduce emissions while keeping rates as low as they can be for our ratepayers. I had a couple questions regarding just sort of on the intertie north to Fairbanks in particular. How large is that, the capacity right now, and what do we need as far as a state goes to the entire rail belt, I guess?
Just speaking through the chair, John Burns, Senator Kawasaki, the what we call the Alaska Intertie is 138 megawatts in size. It has the ability to carry 70 megawatts of energy. All right, and that goes from, I think it's Willow up to Healy. At that point, it splits. We have two. We have, as you're aware, in our service territory, we've got what the Alaska intertie continues on. Then we have what's called the Northern intertie, and so that's the ability to split it and carry more energy. So what we are focused on is one of the first stages is to upgrade the existing Northern intertie, the Alaska intertie, to up to 230, the carry capacity of that significantly more than.
Okay. Follow up?
Actually, I'll follow up with you later, just sure. More detail on that. But just another question regarding that is that if we were to build the intertie, I know that the GVA in particular has worked on some of their long-term clean energy proposals. Decommissioning Healy 2 is part of that proposal in Fairbanks in particular. And then I just heard from Doyon Utilities today, this afternoon, or this morning actually, that at least the proposal about the combined heat and power plant on the military base at Fort Wainwright is part of that. And they're going to, I'm guessing, purchase electricity from somewhere on the grid.
Yes.
And can you just tell me a little bit about how that's going to work? Already the grid is capped out at this.
Yeah, through the chair. You raised a great point. That's the problem is that, you know, you really need to have an electron freeway. And ultimately to get, as I started in my comments, the cheapest electron from wherever it is generated to wherever it needs to be, just without constraint. And that's why we really do need to start today on the build-out that will get us there to the future. Because ideally, even, you know, Fairbanks, specifically the PM2.5 issue that we are grappling with, one sure way to resolve that is electrifying. You know, instead of burning, you know, whether it's fuel oil or wood, you know, electrify. That's how we were many years ago, but it became cost prohibitive. You can't do that without expanded generation, and you certainly can't do that without a transmission system that will allow us to get it from one point to the other. And to follow up on Mr. Izzo's point, and I've said this publicly many, many times, from Golden Valley's perspective, you know, all of us are GT&Ds, generation, transmission, distribution. If it is in our best, if it is in the best interest of our ratepayers, okay, and we can be assured that they have reliable, lower cost energy. We at Golden Valley don't need to own it. We don't need to operate it. We can simply be a distribution utility. But to do that, we have to be assured that we have reliable energy. And we also have to be assured that we're driving forward for lower cost energy.
Right. Yeah, thanks. And just one, and I'll just, I got one other thing on gas contracts. But just I appreciate that the four of you are here together representing the Rail Belt and working toward that ERO. I think that's huge. It's important. Transmission is an issue for all of us up and down the Rail Belt. On the contracts, no, I actually wasn't aware that it was only a year contract for gas for Fairbanks, for Golden Valley. And then do you, for Cook Inlet, we had those introductions from the Division of Oil and Gas in DNR. Do you have, you know, you got multi-year contracts. I know you want the longest term contract you can get in place. Are these being worked out today since the contracts will end in, what, 3 years or 4 years? Is that something that is ongoing? And I don't know that anybody's selling as they were, what, 10 years ago when folks were only wanting one or two contracts.
Tony Izzo, for the record, through the chair, Senator Kawasaki. I'm certain that the answer is going to be similar across all of us, but there's an ongoing discussion with the current producer as well as others all the time. I personally believe that there will be some in-between solution that's figured out. It's just that as an essential service provider, I can't bet on that. I can't just tell my board, hey, don't worry about it. You know, it's March of 28, I'll have this figured out in 2 weeks. It just doesn't work that way. And Senator Giesel, or Chair, Co-Chair Giesel, if I might just take less than a minute to follow up on Mr. Clayman's, Senator Clayman's comments. Senator, just to clarify a point that I made, you mentioned the ERO or SB 123, and I just want to be clear that an integrated resource plan is what that group is in essence to do. And if it were to be legislatively mandated now, then that's where the tension, you know, occurs for me, is it's like fixing the answer before the group ever gets a chance to figure that out. I do, please understand that when it was Senator Kaufman that I think brings up a huge, you know, critical issue around reliability, or that's how I would characterize it. That does not mean that we will not, I'm certain that Matanuska Electric, for example, will do something similar to our other utilities. We will increase our carbon reduction goal. It's 28% by 2027 right now. And if it turned out to be 50% by 2040, that does not, you know, that allows, if I can exceed that and maintain reliability and lower rates, I'll absolutely do it. But please understand that it's an aspirational, you know, it's something the board's holding us to based on circumstances that are changing all the time. Thank you.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to all four of you through the chair, I want to first echo Senator Kawasaki's comments. It's really great to see you all here and working together, transmission and other things you're working on. I know it hasn't always been the case in Alaska's history that our utilities all played so nicely, so thank you for doing that. My question is on slide 12, labeled legislative priorities. There's a picture of this building, which sort of implies that we might be asked to do something or play a role. And then one of them is reasonably priced long-term in-state supply of natural gas. So the DNR presentation we heard a couple days ago, the implication that I took away from that was that this is a naturally declining field or fields in Cook Inlet. And that, frankly, taxes are already so low that there really isn't much incentive we could do to we've already pulled that lever. That lever isn't really available to us. And on the import of LNG, it seems like that is the direction we're going. Everyone has sort of indicated that, at least in the short term. And if a natural gas pipeline is built, wonderful. We're all, even if you did the investment in the import, you'd still be in a better place financially than you are now if we're getting that $5 gas. So my question is, what do you need, if anything, from us to facilitate that LNG import if it has to happen, us being the legislature?
Arthur Miller, Chugach Electric, through the chair. Senator, I think what we need right now, I mean, our goal on this update to you was to let you be aware, fully aware of what we're doing and in the situation that we face, so that when we complete our analysis and our studies, then we can come back with you with a specific recommendation and a specific request, if there is a request coming out of it. I think that is really the best way to go. Let us complete our work. Right now, we're keeping all options open, and as we complete our work and narrow down what those options are going to be, hopefully over the next several months, then that'll give us the ability to establish a direction and give you a specific direction that we're going to take, and then with that, a specific request. On that, and I'm talking about on the gas side.
Follow up, Senator Dunbar?
No, I think that's good. Unless there is some other, if everyone agrees with Mr. Miller, then that's great. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So we are approaching 5 o'clock. This has been great. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here. And we do look forward to having you back to discuss, you know, where you've kind of come to as you complete all the work that you're working on. So thank you very much. Any closing remarks?
I think I'd like to, Arthur Miller, with Chugach Electric, I think I want to first of all thank you all for inviting us to give you an update on where we are. We recognize the electric utility industry is under really fundamental change. All of us collectively have a focus on clean energy. The Chugach Board of Directors just approved a clean energy goal last month, 35% to reduce our carbon impact
by 35% by 2030, and by 50% by 2040. That's front and center for our organization. We're continuing to talk with the various producers and the Cook Inlet, and we hope something will come out of that. However, as Mr. Izzo said, we can't rely on that. But at the same token, we have a very good relationship with Hillcorp in our joint ownership of the Beluga River unit. They're the operator of the field. They've done a remarkable job, and they're a very good business partner for Chugach in the operation of that. And with that, I know we're running out of time. I'll leave it at that, but thank you all very much.
Madam Chair, if I could make a few closing comments. First of all, we are all in this together. We all have the best interests of the state of Alaska at heart. We are all focused on driving down the cost of energy. Aside from the ensuring a stable supply of natural gas, what we can do now is adopt the vision relative to transmission. We can take action today to set the course for the future, because it's going to take a long-term commitment. And if we start it today, we can achieve it over that extended period of time. But the longer we kick the can down the road, we continue to be in this never-ending cycle. Transmission is critical to whatever generation there is. And so that's what, one of the things that I would ask all of us is to very much focus on the long-term plan. And this needs to be the state's vision, because we are working as hard as we can. Fortunately, as Mr. Izzo pointed out, and all of us, are very appreciative of AEA's efforts. They've done a great job. But the concern that we have is if the amount of federal money that we're seeking doesn't materialize, or if none of it materializes, this plan relative to transmission is still nonetheless critical. It's got to be the state's plan. We will be 100% behind that. But it's got to be the state's plan moving forward. And that's the pointed request. Thank
you. Co-Chair Giesel, Co-Chair Bishop, Senators, thank you so much. Tony Izzo, again, for the record. Maybe just a follow-up thought for you is that I appreciate Senator Giesel, the idea of coming back. This is a part of a difficult discussion. I think we intended to come here and just kind of lay the groundwork in terms of giving you a sense of the things that we're looking at. Whatever the solution might be is may not be popular 100%. But I'll give you an example of one. We talked about LNG import in response to Senator Klayman. We all pretty much said 2028 LNG import. But please realize this state has really no resiliency outside of SINGSA. Realize, for example, that NSTAR is still, they're not looking to transition. They need something to put in that pipe. And that's another very important voice in all this, as well as Interior Gas Utility. So the point I want to make is, if we do have to make a decision on LNG import, it's not something that any of us are going to like, but realize that it could serve as a bridge. And then beyond that, let's say a gas pipeline is built, or we shift more rapidly towards renewables or other sources while maintaining reliability. An LNG facility that can store and vaporize gas is still going to be a critical asset that is of value to membership in terms of reliability. We just don't have it. And we had a minute before the meeting, and I indicated I was with the gas utility that had a pipeline to three different states, and that wasn't good enough. We built one to Canada because we had to be sure we had options and redundancy. And we had a propane air mixer as a gas utility, because that was a backup if the pipelines went down. And we had two LNG peakers. Alaska still shocks me 24 years later. So please consider that there are, and as we define this, we'll come and communicate that, hey, this might be a three-year solution, but is there part of the decision-making might be that there is continuing value beyond that. Thank you.
Thank you. Brad, do you have a comment?
Just briefly, through the co-chair,
nothing new to add that my peers haven't stated, and I do appreciate the opportunity, and I recognize it's past five, so I have nothing else to add. Thank you.
You know, I really appreciate the four of you being here together and the unified message. That's so significant. So thank you again. You know, in the future, committee members, we do want to talk to the Department of Revenue related to the costs that we had questions about last time. Fury, Hillcore, and Bluecrest are in the inlet, possible producers. I think we need to hear from them also. But this concludes our meeting for today. I want to announce a couple things. First of all, there's an amendment deadline on Monday, February 6th, for Senator Keel's SB 10. That's the hunting, trapping, and fishing license for disabled vets. And our next meeting won't be for another week. We will not be meeting on Monday due to another scheduled occurrence. But next Wednesday, February 8th, we'll meet at 3:30. We're going to have an overview from the Department of Natural Resources and another opportunity to ask more questions. So at this time, the meeting is adjourned. Let the record reflect. It is 5:05 p.m.